Hello and welcome to The Advance, conversations about news and the Mid-America Union Conference of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I'm Pablo Colindres, Digital Media Manager at the MAUC.
500 years ago on October 31st, Martin Luther nailed his 95 Theses to the church door in Wittenberg, thus beginning one of the most exciting parts of Christian history. To understand more about what that meant, I'm joined by Dr. Benjamin Tyner, Associate Professor of History at Union College.
I'm Ben Tyner. I'm an Associate Professor of History at Union College, and I'm happy to have this conversation with you, Pablo. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Yeah. It's really hard to figure out where to start on the Reformation. It's, especially at the time of Luther, it had already been a long time coming. Mm-hmm. Where could we start context, at least to Luther?
Okay. It's a good question because for a long time, Protestant historians in particular have emphasized the, you know, intense corruption of Catholicism on the eve of the Reformation. And those arguments have a lot of validity. There's a good argument to be made there. Mm-hmm. But the problem with those arguments is that they don't do a very good job at explaining why so many people reject the Reformation. Mm-hmm. Reformation takes hold mainly in Northern Europe and not in Southern Europe. And so you need a kind of explanation that can say, yes, there's this certain corruption problems, inherent problems within the Catholic Church. But at the same time, it's obviously doing a certain amount of work for people that that explains also why people reject it.
Right.
So I guess we could talk a little bit about, sort of the popular context of Christianity on the eve of the Reformation. Would that be good?
Let's start with the essentials. What do we need to understand Luther?
So biographical elements?
Right, yeah.
Okay, well, I think the first thing I would say is, just so people know, there's quite a lively debate about whether the 95 Theses nailed to the church door moment actually happened. on October 31, 1517, we know he mails the 95 Theses essentially to the Archbishop of Mainz, Albrecht. So he does distribute the 95 Theses. It's very plausible that it was also posted on a church door. It wouldn't be unusual.
Right, because that's the announcement board effect then, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So Christian tradition and Protestant tradition says that this happened on the same day, October 31. It may have happened on that day. It may have happened a little later, and it's possible that it didn't actually happen at all. But I tend to believe it occurred. But let's talk a little bit about Luther prior to this moment. Mm-hmm. So just the basics. Son of a miner. Talks about himself as coming from peasant stock, but he's a couple generations removed.
Right.
His dad wants him to go to law school. Mm-hmm. He at some point has a crisis. It's usually described in the middle of a lightning storm, right, where he promises, I think, St. Anne that he will dedicate his life to God if he's spared from this moment. There's also a death of a friend recently that probably contributes to the crisis. And that next day or sometime very soon after, he joins an Augustinian monastery. And he's an Augustinian monk for more than a decade before 1517. And I think that's an important part of the context.
Yeah. Sometimes we forget that he's been in this world for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's a professor also, right, mm-hmm. at this point.
He's been a professor in 15. Let's say the point we're talking about is 1517. In 1517, he's been a teacher for about 9 years. The school in Wittenberg that he teaches at is fairly recently opened. It's a brand new school, mm-hmm. And he lectures on theology. But at the same time, he's also a monk. And I mean, I think it's really important, and most people know this probably, but I think it's really important to understand him as a reformer, right? I mean, he's not intending initially, it doesn't seem, to create any sort of schism. He's sort of driven by a sort of very widespread desire to take the church back to its sources. This is that Latin phrase ad fontes that Renaissance thinkers and reformers share in common. Let's go back to the roots, back to the books, back to the sources. And he has that sort of, it's like the original meaning of revolution, right? So the wheel going back to the beginning.
So a conservative in his time.
Yes, initially, I'd say.
Yeah. So let's talk about 1517 Germany.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
What about it? Like, the just what does it look like on the ground? What is
a normal person? Like?
Okay,
sitting there,
yeah.
Waking up. What does his day consist of?
Well, basically? I mean, it incredibly, you know, it turns on what you say, what normal means, of course. But
right.
So let me just give the sort of social makeup, and then you can focus me if you want on particular areas. But
sounds good.
I think most important thing to understand. Well, let's talk about the political and social context. More than 90% of people in what we'll call Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, German-speaking areas, mm-hmm. live in the countryside. Vast majority of people, everybody in the countryside virtually is illiterate, right? 30% of men in towns are literate. So even the majority of townspeople right. are illiterate. And so I think it's important to understand a largely rural audience. That's important when we're talking about the Reformation, because the Reformation spreads in some ways unequally through cities and countryside. But we'll talk about that later. The Holy Roman Empire is divided up into countless little polities, some ruled by bishops, some ruled by nobles. Luther's noble in his area of Saxony is Elector Frederick. The electors are a group of people who theoretically elect the Holy Roman Emperor, but in practice, there's a candidate that's usually pretty right. obvious. The Holy Roman Empire, well, it's the king who's about to take over in 1517. He's actually not there yet. Charles is heir to one of the biggest empires in world history, which includes Spain, the New World colonies of Spain, Belgium, the Netherlands, the German states, Austria, parts of Italy. It's insanely huge
right.
empire. So he's going to be the person that's showing up really when the most dramatic moments of Luther's trials and stuff are in play.
Mm-hmm.
A couple other kind of social aspects that are probably pretty important to talk about. The status of a peasant typically in 1517. So 1517 is coming after a period of like half a century at least or more of demographic expansion.
Okay.
More and more people. It's bad for peasants. Let's summarize by saying the peasants who survived the Black Death in the 1300s mm-hmm. actually had a pretty good bargaining power after that because of the shortage of labor.
Right.
So we're at a period in which they're losing that bargaining power. There's a lot of laws making that sort of re-insurfing them. And to be a serf is sort of, it's very similar to be a slave to being a slave, except for a couple differences. Serfs are obligated to work several days a week for whoever owns their land. They can't leave the land. They can't marry without permission. Serfs have to pay all the taxes that are available in Germany to be paid, as opposed to nobles and the clergy, who are exempt from things like sales tax, from certain kinds of land taxes, certain kinds of tithes. The poorest people in this context also have the highest tax burden. And in addition, there's famine, right? And especially right. when we're hitting towards the 1520s, that kind of is the background of all of this.
Yeah, I think that's the recipe for something brewing underneath.
Yes, yeah. It's a turbulent situation.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Your entire village life requires you to go to church, and your entry into church means that you need to not be excommunicated, for example. So your priest has a lot of power in that situation. Often mm-hmm. it's also your priest who you're paying taxes to. Mm-hmm. But even the secular authorities in Germany are – their authority is justified by something like the divine right of kings.
Right.
So this is an important point for later, I think, that all secular and religious power that an average person would have been subject to in the 1500s in Germany was justified by an argument that God wants it this way in some ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
That God has put this vertical situation in power.
Gotcha.
So when Luther is going to challenge the spiritual justification of this social hierarchy,
mm-hmm.
implicitly he's also going to challenge the social hierarchy.
Right, because they go hand in hand.
They go
hand in hand. Okay. Right. All right. So, and many of the, I don't want to delve too deep into the ideas Luther had and all that, because
people know that.
Yeah, it's been overdone. There's a new book that just came out, published by the church also, that delves into those ideas and how they relate mm-hmm. to our theology today. So what I wanted to talk about really is what it would have meant at the time for a, say, a peasant who's working his serf land on a normal weekday, going to his local church on Sunday to make sure he's right with the powers that be. And then there's this German monk who's, you know, who's having a little shouting match out there. What's what's going on through that person's mind?
Yeah. I mean, I think I have a couple answers to this, because the part of the question is going to be like, we need to talk about how the Reformation is distributed, right? How the Reformation is created. So, because the first answer, if you were talking about October 31, 1517, the answer is it would have been nothing, right? Because the 95 Theses is in Latin. It's a set of propositions for academic debate. This was not abnormal. This is a very typical thing to do. Let's have an argument.
But then again, it's geared towards educated people, like you said, only 30% of people in cities were
30% of men in cities could read.
Right? Yeah, so it's not going to be something everyone can take a part of. It's not a debate that's open to the public.
No, it was a suggestion. But the things that he's bringing up in the 95 Theses do have a. So when it gets to the peasants, right, when it gets to other the urban poor, it is going to have an impact on them, because discussing, for example, the sale of indulgences is that is something that matters to everyday people in a situation of famine and bad power in the labor market, right, and no power in the labor market. The demand to spend your money in this way. Did to many people seem like evidence of clerical corruption or greed. And I mean, there's can I talk a little bit about Archbishop Albrecht of Mainz?
Sure.
This is the guy who Luther sends the 95 Theses to. And that's in some ways the start of the Reformation, we could say.
What was his relation to Luther?
He was the Archbishop, so of his neighboring boss, Archbishop. Basically. Yeah, he was the one who's authorizing. So if you've heard the story about the salesman of the...
Right,
the
John Tetzel. Yeah.
It's under Archbishop Albrecht's authority that Tetzel is selling those indulgences. And Luther didn't know this, but Albrecht is actually he's occupying two different religious positions, which is called pluralism. It's something that people and reformers had criticized for a long time, because he's collecting sort of two sets of revenues from two different positions. Obviously, he can't be available to both of those parishioners, in both of those areas equally. He also bought that job from both of those people, both of those jobs. He paid a ton of money for it. And to get that money, he borrowed huge sums of money from a German bank called the Fuggers, which is one of the biggest banks in Europe. So he's taking these huge loans to buy these two religious offices, which he's then going to collect money from. Now, Luther, I don't think, knew at the time that he had these two offices, or were not at least clear that – certainly he didn't know that he took this big loan from the Fuggers.
Gotcha.
But what the Pope has allowed Albrecht to do with regards to indulgences is to collect essentially half of the revenue. So a lot of people think of indulgences as this is the Pope collecting money for St. Peter's Basilica. Partly, yes. But also what the Pope has said is, okay, Albrecht, you actually can keep half that revenue to pay back the money that you use to buy these offices. Right.
Wow.
So and so it's not simply about the Pope's collection of money. It's also about these local religious officials. So one thing to think about is that it's Albrecht who's allowing these indulgences to be sent.
Okay.
He's the one that Luther sends that letter to. So for the everyday person, again, in this moment, they're not party to any of this. They have no clue this is going on. But the things that Luther is complaining about affects the everyday person, right?
Right.
Significantly. So let's take another group of people besides separate from the peasants in the towns. And this is the group of people that really are the first audience of Luther in the Reformation is other reformers like him, but especially Christian humanists, right?
Mm-hmm.
People who think you need to go back to the sources. And so when he talks about sola scriptura, they're really interested in what he has to say there.
Part of his ideological peers, basically.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's really one of the first nodes of the distribution of the Reformation, you can see, is the German humanists in cities.
Okay.
And this overlaps with the printers, right? The people who are printing this stuff and distributing it. And I mean, I think they're more important than what happens at the door, what does or does not happen at the church door, right? Because they're the people who take it off the church door and mass produce it, right?
Would they translate it into?
Yes. Within a couple of weeks, German and mass produced. So it's really the first audience is really German cities, northern German cities who have universities. These are the people that are creating the demand for books that the printing press is serving.
Gotcha.
And reformers. And these people are already engaged in a whole bunch of different ways in critiquing, attempting to reform the Catholic Church. But then you can sort of take it after it, and we could talk about the distribution networks of the printing press if you want a little bit more about that. But that's really what's happening in the cities.
Okay.
You want to talk a little bit more about the cities? Or
yeah, let's talk about the cities here. So there are people who are already not fully content with how things are going. Is that?
Yeah.
I'm getting that right.
So, I mean, one way, the traditional kind of class understanding of the Reformation is to talk about how the nobility dominated both secular and church positions. And there's this huge new group of educated middle-class people in the cities who feel like they should have access to these church positions.
Right, because they know things.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. They've been studying this. They've been studying the Bible. They've been studying canon law. Give us these positions that that often the second or third kid of a noble gets, right? Sort of, or buys. And so their sort of desire for those things. But there's also this huge controversy exactly at the same time as 1517. With a Christian humanist named Reuchlin in Germany, and the Jews, because there's this sort of official proclamation that a bunch of sort of local Jews have to turn in all of their books, and their books are going to be burned and banned. And the humanists are like, no, this is good stuff, even for Christians. This is good stuff. This is it. We should learn Hebrew. We should actually use these texts.
Right.
And there's a huge controversy and a demand that says, that, you know, like let's preserve these writings, even if they disagree with us in certain respects. There's something good that educated Christians can get out of that. So that kind of audience that wants to, like Erasmus, right? Thomas More. In England, this kind of audience that wants to go back to get better versions of the Bible. There's a huge attempt to make the Vulgate, you know, the medieval translation of the Bible, more accurate or closer to its roots. That group of people are often, even though Luther can't really be called a humanist, that group of people is very interested in what Luther has to say. And again, use universities in Germany, almost exclusively, very recent phenomenon, late medieval phenomenon in Germany.
Got it.
So that educated audience is a big part of this. Mm-hmm. And then you could also talk about the artists, right, who in the cities – if you think about how the Reformation is going to spread through cities and then out into the countryside, it's really important to talk about the people who are creating the visual media.
Right, the link between the people who can read and who can't read.
Exactly.
So who see the things.
So there's these people from universities, like the preachers often. Luther has a colleague named Karlstadt at Wittenberg who's very radical, and he begins wearing peasant clothes and he goes out. So he does early reformers, they're doing a lot of preaching. So people might hear this stuff out loud at a sermon. They might, if they can't read, they might be read to. The Reformation relies on this distribution network of visual printing. And that's really important. Lucas Cranach, the elder, and Albrecht Dürer are the most famous names. But these are the kind of people who take the most simple versions of Luther's ideas and make them visual. One of the most powerful series, I think, is this Christ Antichrist thing that's done, where they have, for example, an image of Jesus being fitted for the crown of thorns, and the next it says Christ, and the next image is the Pope having his four level papal tiara placed on his head, Antichrist.
Right.
That's not a theological treatise, but it's very understandable to people. And there's kind of this direct contrast. It's totally visual. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of the popular element of the Reformation comes through that kind of media.
Right. So like basically the early political cartoons.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So what I'm seeing here is a line between that goes Luther to the humanists and the humanists to the peasantry. Is that kind of
Humanists and other kinds of reformers. I'm not saying they're all exactly humanists, but the sort of educated town elite.
Mm-hmm.
Elite is a complicated word, but the sort of educated, we could call it educated middle class of the cities, really does seem to be, it seems to me, the first audience. And then, out from there.
Okay.
So where was Christianity on the eve of the Reformation in a popular sense?
Mm-hmm.
And there's quite a bit of evidence to say that Christianity in the early 1500s, let's say, is furiously engaged. It is not, there's nothing secular about this world, right? And a lot of the sort of Protestant scholarship talks about there is a need for what Luther provides. But I mean, where you see that is you can find anti-clericalism, right? Everywhere. And you can find it in Italy as well. But there's a certain version of German anti-clericalism that's really important here. And I'll talk a little bit about the nationalism later, but there is huge evidence to say that there's popular devotion on an unheard of degree in this period, like tons of anxiety. And Luther actually plays on this anxiety. I think this is not often discussed enough. Luther is an incredibly apocalyptic thinker.
I mean, there's nothing secular about this world.
Right.
So every conversation you have, whether you're a peasant or an elite, it's going to hinge around your religion and where to think it's going, what's with your soul, basically, right?
Right. But there's apparently, it seems like that there is evidence for an incredible, you know, popular anxiety. Mm-hmm. So like, I think you can imagine part of this coming from things like the sale of the way that indulgences are peddled, right? Mm-hmm. Which is
you're going to be stuck in
purgatory
for years and years.
So you have this anxiety created by sort of the focus on hell, right? Constant focus on hell and concern with judgment. The sense that the end of the world is coming, which is not, it's not just Protestants who are preaching this. I mean, Columbus believed this really as well. But some Christians focus on it much more. And there does seem to be, especially in early Luther, this just sense that what his movement represents to him and what other signs that he collects represent is that this is the imminent end of the world, right? Mm-hmm. Something is changing here. So I think the people who respond to Luther, in part, some of them respond through this because he's resolving this sense of anxiety and concern with salvation, right? And that's more about the ideas.
Gotcha.
There is a sincere popular demand. We see it everywhere for mm-hmm. spiritual leadership and consolation. And some people don't seem to find that in the Orthodox Catholic Church. For some people, just as a counterpoint, for some people, it does seem even through the Reformation that the sacrament of penance offers a very clear method of resolving that anxiety. Mm-hmm. For other people, it feels like a very stressful obligation.
Right, and a little detached too. Like it's mm-hmm. somehow I'm doing this here, but I don't see the results happening here now.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's to sum it up, there Christianity in Germany, let's say, on the eve of the Reformation, is incredibly engaged, devotional, apocalyptic Christianity on the popular level. Now, whether that's going to whether that turns into the Reformation or not, it sort of depends. It can go either way. Mm-hmm. But it's not a secular society. It's an incredibly engaged group of Christians there. I think late medieval Christianity brought people into the process in a sense, like they were anxious about where to look for authority in a way that was kind of new.
At what point does a peasant feel involved in this conversation?
Well, we can see it in a couple of different places. I think the first thing to say is that what happens as a result of Luther's success in the early Reformation in terms of publications and readership and the mm-hmm. fact that people are going over to his side is that you start to see Catholic publishing competing for the audience.
What point it gets to peasants.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, you're certainly talking about something. This is the first time in human history that we know of that you can really see a national celebrity emerge. But it's not just Luther. You can see it in some of the mm-hmm. Renaissance artists, for example. I think Michelangelo is the first person to have a biography written about him in his lifetime, right? So, like, the idea that lots of people know who this person is. Okay, so Luther and Luther's propagandists and marketers are a really important part of this process. So, I think one thing that I've already suggested is that there's plenty of people who would say that there is a need for what Luther is offering, but at the right. same time, there's also the manufacturing and selling of Luther's images mm-hmm. in a very careful way, and Luther courts this. So
this is done by the printers and that network of
exactly, yeah. The printers and also Melanchthon, who's like Luther's right hand man, who has a lot to do with a lot of this. Luther is. There's also this sense of nationalism. So I think mm-hmm. this is maybe one. So you see a lot of German people getting involved and getting behind Luther when Luther very carefully begins to court Germans explicitly. So like mm-hmm. the first time you see this is 1520, I think, where he writes his address to the German, to the nobility of the German nation. And he says, essentially in German, he says, he doesn't say we need to stop sending our money to the Pope. He mm-hmm. says Germans need to stop sending their money to Italians, right? And that's a very careful courting of Italian noble position, right?
And he's saying this in German.
Exactly. At the same time, Luther is also courting the public, right? By the way he writes, he's a very – I mean, if A lot of people don't really only have read Luther's theological treatises. He's right. a very earthy, even dirty writer.
Yeah.
And that has a certain popular appeal. But also, I think, just to say one thing about idea, if that's okay.
Yeah.
The priesthood of all believers, to me, is a crucial step in the entry of the peasants into this.
Right.
Because the priesthood of all believers says... this is, again, I think first formulated in 1520, something like that. Again, that's three huge treatises in 1520. He's not been excommunicated yet. Mm-hmm. But he's in the priest of all believers. The idea is essentially we're all priests, right? We can all access Jesus and God directly.
Yeah.
We don't need to go through intermediaries. We don't need to require the intercession of the saints.
We don't need to pay, basically. It's not a pay to play.
Like, exactly.
Yeah.
There's a spiritual equality. Now, what Luther seems to have been surprised by is that people took that spiritual equality to mean a social equality. Mm. But in retrospect, it seems very silly to me that he couldn't have understood this because
like you said before, like the nobles were the ones who were controlling the clergy at all times, if they're not the clergy themselves.
If your social hierarchy is justified with a spiritual doctrine of hierarchy. Spiritual equality undermines the social hierarchy. So at a time in which there is incredible famine, mothers are deciding which kid to feed, basically, and required to do 3 days of forced labor, right, for the guy up on the hill and pay to carry the tax burden.
And Luther says, still pay for your soul.
Precisely. And the tithe, which was compulsory, right, and often quite onerous. At that exact moment, Luther says, there is no justification for this social hierarchy.
Not only is the media, the readings, the picture, all the visual stuff is, it's things that they can quickly connect to. Mm-hmm. But then you also introduce this idea that spiritually, which is really all that matters, you know, that's what all your life is surrounded by. You're equal to that person up there in the hill.
Exactly.
Why am I down here getting stomped on, basically?
Why do I have to choose which kid to feed if spiritually we're equal? And the reason I'm serving him is because he's told me he's spiritually above me, right?
Right.
And can I talk a little bit about Luther's reaction to this?
Yes, please. Because he wasn't happy about
Luther's position needs to be understood, obviously. If you want to be sympathetic to Luther about this story I'm about to tell, which is kind of one of the dark sides of Luther, is to understand that noble protection was crucial to the survival of Luther's Reformation.
Right.
He had to have noble support. And Luther, literally, after the Council of Worms, 1521, that's the here I stand, I can do no other moment. He's kidnapped by Frederick, his noble lord, essentially,
protected,
out of kindness, right? And he whisks him away to a castle where he grows a beard and calls himself Knight George and translates the Bible into German, New Testament into German.
Yeah.
But while that's happening, while he's sort of in hiding, the peasant revolution, as we'll call it later, right, 1524-5, begins to explode. And this is a revolution often against nobles, right?
Right.
And the nobles are protecting him. And at the same time, the peasants are saying Luther is giving us the justification to rebel against the nobles.
Oh, so that's like a conflict of interest for him.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And so, and literally the nobles are looking to Luther and they're saying, advise us. Like, what are we supposed to do? They say they're doing this. Are they really reflecting your ideas? And so Luther writes this dramatic document against the peasants. So the full title is something like Against the Murderous Thieving Hordes of Peasants, right? and it's a chilling document because essentially he tells the nobles that wherever you find a rebellious peasant, smite, strangle, or stab, like mad dogs, cut them down. The worst line to me is, I won't get it exactly right, but it's something like, for we are come upon such strange times when a man may more easily win heaven by the shedding of blood than others by prayers. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a horrifyingly un-Luther line.
Right.
Win heaven.
Yeah.
Win heaven. Not only are you winning heaven by a work, but the work is killing someone with a rake, right? Or a shovel as a weapon. And so as a response to this, the nobles who have the monopoly on violent technology, essentially, you know, they ride down these people with pitchforks and what have you. And they kill, conservative estimates, over 100,000 peasants. Very few nobles die as a result of this. So Luther at that point, Luther's saying, like, no, I just meant spiritual equality. I did not mean social equality, yeah. right? I never intended for you to rise against your God-ordained superiors. And it's just a very upsetting moment because it's Luther, you know, it's Luther. There's a certain sort of naive radicalism in early Luther, which is refreshing to someone like me, at least,
right.
where he seems to depart at that moment from that.
Basically, his success is based on the German populace. You know, because they embrace his ideas, including the electors later on. Mm-hmm. It could have been different.
Well, I mean, I think the way you can sort of compare Luther to other people like him in, say, the 1400s, like mm-hmm. Wycliffe and Hus, right, or even Savonarola, right, in Italy, who calls the Pope a whore. Mm-hmm. But he does this because he says the wealth of the papacy, the corruption of the papacy, and of course he's burned to death. The thing that seems to set Luther dramatically apart, as you said, is these networks of information distribution, right, mm-hmm. and the sort of the appetite in Germany for that kind of stuff, and the distance from Rome. Right. And gotcha. I think that's important. So Southern mm-hmm. Europe stays Catholic largely.
Right? Yeah, but then Jan Hus is also not as close to Rome as everyone else.
Right. But he's earlier. Right. And I mean, in some sense, it could have gone very differently. Let's put it that way.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the key turning points, if you want to think of one moment where Luther's Reformation could have been over, it's Worms, right? Worms, that moment where he says, "Here I stand, I can do no other," and he refuses to recant his works unless scripturally demonstrated that they're false. It seems like there was every reason to believe that at the end of that meeting, he was going to be taken to Rome and put on trial and likely executed. Mm-hmm. And Luther's stubbornness, I think he would not have backed down from even the fire. But that sort of decision of Elector Frederick to seize him and hide him away mm-hmm. By force, right? Which maybe Luther wouldn't have done without that decision. I think it was crucial because at that moment you could have very easily imagined. Typically, Luther would have been killed soon after that. But then the other thing is his ideas by 1521 had incredible wide distribution.
Yeah,
right. And that's really the dramatic difference from other reformers in earlier.
And so this is part of the way that he molded the German identity, including the German language. So his Bible, I'm sure, had a lot to do with him molding the language too, as well.
Absolutely, yeah. There's like I don't know the exact stats, but there's a huge amount of German words today that take their original spelling from Luther's New Testament. Hmm. So the written German language, in particular, right, is shaped dramatically by Luther. I mean, I think one other thing you could say about the sort of that popular support that's coming from cities mm-hmm. is just there's a very widespread interest in Germany of people to sort of gain some amount of independence for representatives of the church. There's that peasant desire to gain independence from
themselves, basically.
Yeah, monetary independence, yeah. right, and taxation, those kinds of things. There is an urban desire for independence from both secular and religious authorities, these medieval communes and these universities that are sick of the sort of oversight of the nobility, mm-hmm. This middle-class desire to have more independence and less oversight and lose less of their revenue, which really explains a lot of this. And it's also this desire of the nobles, right, to sort of declare independence from both Rome and the Holy Roman Emperor, who never ceases becoming Catholic, being Catholic, right? So that's, I think, there's a ceiling on access to certain jobs, to certain financial independence that Luther is able to put into nationalistic terms, right?
I'm sure we all know that Luther wasn't a saint, basically.
Yeah.
You know, but he did, and like I said, a lot of his arguments were based on this nationalism. Mm-hmm. He had a huge hand in creating basically the modern German language.
Yeah.
And that's always a basis for an identity. Mm-hmm. What did that have to do with his anti-Semitism? Mm-hmm. To what extent?
Well, I mean, I think, and it's important to say, like, I think if you grew up Adventist, or at least at one period in time, you got Luther as a saint. I did. And right. I think that the huge problem in presenting Luther as a saint is that when he finally seeks out, it's very devastating, right? And, mm-hmm. and you throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I think it's important to sort of like always talk about the rounded Luther, right?
Right.
And there's the elements of Luther which are the peasants and that kind of thing, which are a very dark side of his personality.
Yeah.
He has this incredibly angry emotional style sometimes, and other times he's got this very careful theological rational mode, and I think that's probably a key to some of his popularity, but it's also some of the worst stuff you read of his seems kind of like to me he wrote it in a fit of rage, right? And probably okay. the next morning was a little bit like stunned by way. Oh, yeah. Did that already go to the printers? Anti-Semitism. So early in his career, he's actually relatively wonderful on the issue of Jews. Mm-hmm. He talks about, essentially he says, why would Jews become Christians when this is our Christianity, right? So he says he essentially talks about the corruption of Christianity as the reason that we shouldn't hold Jews to account for not converting. Unfortunately, you'd like it to go the other direction, but as he gets older, he becomes much more violently anti-Semitic. He seems to have thought that once he purified Christianity, all the Jews would come over to his side. Mm. And that's part of his apocalyptic. I think he thinks of himself as a sign of the times, that he's going to be a seal and that everyone's going to come over to his way of thinking. When Jews decide that, no, we're good with our ancient traditions, he begins to really lose it in a series of sermons, which really kind of are the capstone of his career. It's, 1540s, let's say. I think its last sermon is a vicious attack on the Jews, but probably one of his bestsellers in the 1500s.
So it was well received
on the Jews and their lives. Yeah,
gotcha. I think that's where I want to go next. So this is all of this. At this point, what is his? What is his image among his peers, but among the Germans, basically?
He's a huge celebrity in the parts of Germany that have gone over to the Reformation.
Okay.
Right? By the 1540s, the Protestant part of the Protestant Reformation comes to this moment where electors protest against mm-hmm. the requirement of the Holy Roman Emperor to become Catholic, and begins a real violent part of the war. So those many noble states, and again, the nobles have found a lot of interest in supporting Luther in terms of grabbing power vis-a-vis the emperor.
Right.
So the emperors that went over to the Reformation in those areas, Luther is often a huge celebrity, and in other areas as well. Mm-hmm. There's other parts of Europe that have gone over to a different version of the Reformation by now, right? Mm-hmm. We know about Calvin's Geneva and Zwingli's Zurich. And there's a industry of secret printing in France as well, the Huguenots and so on.
Right.
But so Luther's very popular, and I mean maybe you're leading me towards how would people have received his anti-Semitism? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, basically. How people received basically most of his stuff. But I'm guessing that if at this point you're used to agreeing with him, mm-hmm. he puts out this treatise, yeah. and you're like, oh, well, that makes sense because everything else he's done makes sense. Right. So,
well, and as you're implying, there's a fairly long tradition by this point of Christian anti-Semitism in Europe, mm-hmm. In Germany included. Really, the first time you see it become very violent is after the First Crusade or during the First Crusade. One of the first things, there's a bunch of German barons after the First Crusade is called in 1095 who say, mm-hmm. why go all the way over there to kill people who don't believe in Christ when the killers of Christ are right here, right? Mm-hmm. As they say it. And they just horrible accounts of them going into towns and slaughtering men, women, and children. So there's a fairly long, and I mean, just in case someone doesn't know, and you cut this if you need to, but just in case someone doesn't know, the typical way of explaining medieval German anti-Semitism or medieval European anti-Semitism is to talk about wealth. Right.
Okay.
So Christians are prohibited. I can go in more detail, but I'll just give the summary. Christians are typically prohibited from lending money at interest. Mm-hmm. Right. It's called usury. It's understood as a very dramatically bad sin. Right.
Yeah.
Jews are prohibited almost everywhere for owning land, which is typically the way wealth was. The majority of wealth was in land. So in 1400s and 1500s, where you see this urbanization happening in Europe, you see a move towards movable wealth and cash economy. Many people seem to have sort of increasingly understood Jews as getting a sort of unfair deal, even though even though sort of the reason it might be true that disproportionate amount of Jews were involved in the money economy, it's true, but it's obviously not totalizing. But the reason for that was prejudicial, right? They were not right. allowed to own land, wealth, essentially. So. And they're given this little job that Christians aren't allowed to do. Then that becomes banking becomes the way of the future. A lot of people felt resentful, I think, towards Jews who were involved in. They assumed that all Jews were involved in commerce, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's a typical way a historian would explain where a lot of this resentment is coming from. That's not simply theological.
Right.
But the point being, on the Jews and their lies, that's Luther's most famous anti-Semitic treatise and is probably one of his bestsellers. It was on Hitler's bookshelf later on. Now, I'm not, you know, it's hard to draw a direct line. But at the same time, I think it's important if you read on the Jews and their lies, and people should, I think, to understand the dramatic nature of what he's saying. He says we should abolish safe passage on the roads, which is essentially a license to kill. Mm-hmm. We should burn their synagogues. We should burn their books. We should. It's a very Kristallnacht-y kind of treatise. And if, as you say, Luther is given credit with forming part of that early German nationalism, it's probably fair to give him some credit, at least, for fusing anti-Semitism with that. Let's stop. Okay. Luther's last sermon is an anti-Semitic screed, essentially. Mm-hmm. And there's a set of Lutheran pastors in Switzerland very soon after Luther's death who essentially take his suggestions and run with them. And they attack Jewish communities. So there's a very direct tie you can make to violence against Jews instigated by Lutheran pastors.
Right.
Now, I mean, you can't say that all Lutheran pastors would pursue this strategy, but the uncomfortable thing is thinking about how much of Luther's appeal might have been because he was anti-Semitic, right? Rather than for the good reasons that we justly appreciate him. Right. But there's another part to, so we have Luther on the peasants, Luther on the Jews. You see some of Luther's darker side. There's also Luther who is unwilling to create unity in the Protestant Reformation at certain moments, key moments. Mm-hmm. There's a moment where Zwingli, who's this Christian humanist in Zurich, right, in Switzerland, in this thriving urban city, and Zwingli invites Luther to a conference because Zwingli needs troops. And right. Luther has access to the nobles, mm-hmm. and he could support Zwingli's his ability to fend off Catholic attempts to conquer Zurich. And there's this conference, and Luther and Zwingli are there. And Luther says, "Well, basically, I'll send you some support as long as we can come to some agreement about a couple key points, right?" And Luther, there's this frustrating argument. Colloquy, Marburg colloquy, that's what it's called, the Marburg colloquy. There's this argument about the nature of the Eucharist, right? The nature of communion, Last Supper, the Mass. And their difference appears to us as fairly subtle, right? Mm-hmm. But both of them want to say that there is, that literal presence has been overstated of Jesus in the body, and the body and the blood in the bread and the wine.
Well, it's such a huge part of that, the whole Catholicism.
But Zwingli wants to take a slightly harder line, right? Mm-hmm. And he wants to say, no, this is a purely symbolic gesture. It's important, but it's a symbolic gesture. It's a community affirming. And Luther's like, well, not quite only symbolic. And their difference feels like a fine point. And you're right. It was very important to both of them. But you kind of felt you feel when you're looking back that Luther could have said, okay, we'll work on this later.
Yeah,
let me first back you and get some troops. Instead, Luther says, he ends the meeting. He says, no, we can't work together because we disagree. You have not listened to me.
Oh, man.
Right? I have purified Christianity and you didn't get the right answer. And Zwingli dies swinging his sword in the streets. Right? He's mowed down by Catholics in the streets because you could say definitely Luther could have stopped that from happening, but didn't. Right. So there's a whole bunch of these moments where Luther's stubbornness, I think in retrospect, makes him look incredibly unkind, uncharitable to others who are moved by his message to some extent. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, to not just entirely to be critical of him, it's obviously that stubbornness also, which makes him the person who's able to challenge the papacy, right?
Right.
Who's brave enough to say, burn me, go ahead. I will stand by these words. Uh-huh. I'm not, his stubbornness is both his most beautiful and most important for Protestants to think about this without purely the triumphalism that we've approached this with in many generations. There's a lot to celebrate about Luther. And yet there's not only the dark side of Luther, but there's also a lot of everyday Christians. And there had been no other Christianity in the areas that Luther lived in, right? A lot of everyday Christians, sincere Christians, people trying to live as close to God as possible, remain Catholic. Right. And in the wars of religion that follow this, there is a total willingness on both sides to kill the other side because of the certainty that we have the truth, which takes incredibly brutal forms. Right. You have Calvin burning people in Geneva for not believing the Trinity. Of course, you have Catholics making martyrs out of Protestants, and both sides are lifting up the people who have been killed by the other side as martyrs and completely ignoring the martyrs that they're making for the other side. Mm-hmm. And so these kind of print networks are going to be in total isolation from each other and are going to drive this continuing war of religion. When reading through these documents, it's wonderfully refreshing to have someone like Montaigne say, "What do I know?" Right? It's just such a relief that I know. Is there anything that I would kill for, or be so certain that I would brutally kill a lot of people for? There's that beginning, but it's also important to think about the way that Catholics responded to the Reformation in some very healthy ways. There's certain things that Catholics double down on that Protestants think are still wrong, but there's other things that I think they. If you ask a Catholic historian today, they will tell you that the Renaissance papacy, the papacy that Luther is rejecting, is the most corrupt period in Catholic history. The papacy. Okay. Yeah. They will tell you that the sale of indulgences, which are outlawed at the Catholic at the Council of Trent, indulgences say to some extent, but they are outlawed. The sale of them is an outlaw. They say basically Luther was right. This is opening up a whole world of evil in which people who are wealthy essentially have easier access to heaven. They acknowledge that Luther was right about the importance of presenting Jesus and God as accessible to humans. And so they asked artists and authors after the Council of Trent to present Jesus in a more humanized way. So Caravaggio, when he makes his paintings, makes Jesus as an everyday person who looks among us and puts scenes of the arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane in clothes that were contemporary, right? And so there's certain ways that Catholics, what's often called the Counter-Reformation, Catholic Reformation officially, the response to the Reformation, and some very important ways Catholics say, you know what? This was bad. We were going in the wrong direction. And Luther, and we'll say, and even today, if you read, most Catholic historians say that Luther was a genuine man of faith who created important changes in Catholicism as well.
Yeah.
I think we can also take some really interesting lessons about authority from this. Luther is, Luther goes into the Reformation as a rebellious figure, right? He's someone who is burning the papal bull of his excommunication, right? He's a radical. But then he responds to the radicalism of the movement he created by demanding authority. And he's increasingly, I would argue, despotic about his authority.
His authority, yeah.
He says over and over again, the most sort of horrifying line, "No man can deny my gospel." My gospel, right?
Right, yeah.
Not our gospel, my gospel.
Yeah, like you said before, he's very attended his own image as his harbinger of the purification.
And while he's very aware of the way in which the papacy and Catholicism and Christian tradition have been interpreting scripture and maybe over sanctifying their interpretations, once he believes he's purified Christianity, he entirely forgets that he's in the process of interpreting. Right. For example, I mean, the sola scriptura, he says over and again, scripture alone, we look to scripture alone, but he's also totally willing to get rid of James as a book.
Right.
He thinks it shouldn't be in the Bible. Right. He forgets that he is also in the act of interpretation. And so that he says that his theology becomes the gospel itself. And when someone disagrees with his interpretation, they are by definition they rebels. Become heretics,
yeah.
Right? He calls them rebels who be, I mean, the, with the Peasants' Revolt, he calls them mad dogs that should be slain, mm-hmm. Strike, smite, strangle, and stab. He regularly, he approves of the brutal suppression of anyone who disagrees with them. So I think that's a very interesting transition, which has lots to teach us in the modern context, right? Sort of like in opposition, Luther is willing to allow a certain kind of richness and textured interpretations of Christianity,
right.
But in power, he requires everyone to submit to his interpretation.
Mm. All right. Well, thanks for coming out. Hopefully, we can do some more of these history studies with you, sir.
It's been my pleasure.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for listening to The Advance. Please join us next time.